Hey guys, it's Allie. Welcome back to Infertile AF, the podcast. This is episode 260 called Julia Carroll. Okay guys, before we get started, I just wanted to let everybody know that my children's book called Work of Art, which is about IVF and assisted reproductive technology, is available now. The official pub date is February 20th, but it's available for pre-order right now. It's at infertileafgroup.com, my website, so go there and check it out. And you can get a personalized copy, a numbered limited edition copy. There's a few left, or you can get a non-personalized copy, up to you. But it tells a story of how I told Sonny that he was born through IVF. So it's really great. The reception so far has been awesome. Thank you to everybody who's purchased one or gifted one. Let me know if you guys have any questions, but definitely check out Work of Art at infertileafgroup.com. Thank you. Okay, guys, today I am talking to a really interesting, very smart, dynamic woman named Julia Carroll. She is the host of the Storked podcast, which talks about all different ways to build a family. And she is very, very cool. She's going to tell us her solo mom by choice story. So she's going to talk about having her son, everything she went through to have him, including IUIs, IVF, loss, all the things, picking out donor sperm. We really get into it. We talk about financials. We talk about emotions. It's a really, really great conversation. She is an open book and I love her for it. So definitely you are going to love this one. Definitely listen to her Storked podcast. And without further ado, this is Julia's infertility story. Hi, Julia. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thanks for doing this. Let's start at the beginning. Did you always want to have kids?
I always wanted to have kids. Yeah, it's just been something that it was a no-brainer for me. Like, it's always been in my heart. It's always been in my soul. Like, I just have always imagined myself as a mom.
Okay. So I always like to talk to my guests about what they knew about sex education. And it seems like everybody kind of had the same-ish, you know, lack thereof education. What was yours like? What did you know about fertility and getting pregnant and becoming a parent and all that stuff?
Oh my gosh. It's so funny that you asked that. Yeah. I would say that my experience is probably typical of those of us who grew up in the 90s. I graduated high school in 2000. Mm-hmm. God, I hate saying that.
Oh girl, I was 92. So you're fine.
So I went to an all girls high school. So our sex education was the typical banana condom situation, don't get pregnant, but it was twinged with this like extra level of fear around men and sex and penises and all those things. I think we just felt like we were in a bubble and we had to be really protective of ourselves and guys could be scary. And so not only was the sex education limited about how to get pregnant, there was a lot of fear instilled in us about pregnancy.
Okay. So was it like, ooh, boys have cooties, like that kind of vibe?
Yeah, it was more like boys only want one thing from girls and that's sex and you could end up a pregnant teen and, you know, we're educating you to be strong, independent women and to change the world and have careers. And so don't let sex or boys get in the way of that. Okay. That was kind of the message, I think, if I remember that far back.
Okay. So fast forwarding a whole bunch. Tell me about when you decided that you wanted to start building your family and like what that looked like for you.
Yeah. So I had a couple of relationships that were long-term and like long-term serial dater. There was somebody I met in college and he was my first boyfriend and we dated for 8 years. And I thought like, for sure, this guy and I were going to get married. And I actually ended that relationship for a couple of reasons. And it didn't occur to me at the time that that choice and that relationship might impact my future fertility or family building. I just was like, of course I'm going to meet the next guy. Of course I'm going to have a family. Mm-hmm. And my mom kind of questioned me at the time, like, you know, you're 27 years old. Is this going to impact your family building? Or is this going to impact your ability to find a partner and have kids? And I dismissed it. And it wasn't until my early 30s when I was dating casually a bunch of bozos and whatever. And, you know, and started to say, wait a minute, I need to date not just for fun, not just for somebody who's going to be entertaining and interesting to hang out with for a couple of months, but for the long run. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to realize, wait, there's not that many great guys out there. And I'm sorry to any men who are listening to this. There are great guys, but I wasn't meeting many of them.
Right.
And I met somebody in my early 30s. We dated for 5 years. And I think I really was forcing a relationship to work because I was like, this is the time to settle down, get married, and have kids. Mm-hmm. Right.
And did you, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Absolutely.
Did you feel like to have a family, you had to have a partner and it had to look a certain way and like the societal norms and all that? Or were you starting to think outside the box, like maybe I don't need somebody, maybe I could do this on my own?
Yeah, both. At that time in my early 30s, I still had the societal norms as like, I need to date with the intention of marrying somebody and having kids with that person. And it was creeping into the back of my brain as the relationship was failing. And I was looking around at other men out there and thinking, I don't know that this is going to work out for me. This thought of maybe doing it on my own was starting to inch into my mind. Mm-hmm. And that really started to percolate after I broke up with this gentleman, or he broke up with me when I was 35. And it was one of those breakups, you know, those breakups that like leave you on your knees and like shatter your worldview and like, just destroy your soul. And you're
yes.
thinking, like, how did a boy do this to me? Like
crying and pounding yes. the ground, like in a movie and like driving past his house. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes, totally. It was that. It was like a life shattering event. And it wasn't because he was that great, right? It wasn't like I've lost the love of my life. It was two things. It was like, am I lovable? Which is, I think, a question that many of us go through in our 30s when we're in the dating world. Like, is there something wrong with me that I'm deeply unlovable? Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time with a therapist and trying to figure that one out. And then it was really, can I have a family? This guy just broke up with me. I'm in my mid-30s. How the hell am I going to have a family? And so the solo parenting choice started to become more real, and it started to feel like, okay, this is an option, and it's a plan B that I'll explore for a little bit. And then the plan B just increasingly felt more like a plan A for mm-hmm. me. It started to feel like really good as an option, not just, I guess I have to do this thing on my own, but like, hey, I get to do this thing on my own maybe. And so that was a very gradual progression from yeah. I have to have a partner in my life too. I don't have a partner in my life. How am I going to have kids too? You know, doing it on my own might be great. And I'm really lucky. And that is that I had an aunt who was a solo parent, which was very unusual at the time.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, did you have any close friends or family members who were solo parents by choice?
Yeah. I grew up, my cousin, who is almost like a brother to me, he's just like one of my favorite people in the face of the earth. His mom chose solo parenting in the 80s.
Wow.
Which is,
that's kind of groundbreaking at that time, right?
It really
is.
Just
not very talked about.
Not very talked about. And it was very normal in my family that she had chosen this. So she was a big expander for me. When I ultimately said, this is something I think I'm going to pursue with seriousness, you know, before I'd make the final, like, this is 100% something I'm going to do, but this is something I'm likely going to do. I ended up talking to everyone I knew about their family lives generally, but also specifically sought out solo parents. And mm-hmm. I got on the phone with everyone I could. And I said, what is the experience like? Mm-hmm.
What were some of the specific questions that you were asking these people?
Yeah. I'll tell you first that everyone to a T, like everyone said, it's the best thing I've ever done, but don't do it.
Oh, interesting. Why?
Yeah. I think it's hard. It's just a really hard choice. And I think if you hear the words, don't do it, and you say, yeah, but I'm going to do it anyway, this feels right to me, mm-hmm. then it's your path. And if you hear the reasons why not to do it, and those seem right to you, then it's not your path, mm-hmm. right? It's not for everyone. Just like choosing to have kids is not for everyone, and choosing to be in a heterosexual relationship is not for everyone. That's not a choice. I didn't mean to characterize it as that, but each of us have our own paths and we have to get really clear with what's right for us. Mm-hmm. So consistently I heard, this is really hard. Don't do it. This mm-hmm. is really hard. Don't do it. And I ignored that. And I'm really glad I did. But the questions I was asking were, do you feel lonely? Mm. Right. You're alone. Do you feel alone? I was asking questions like, what are the logistics? Like how do you on a day-to-day basis do it? Mm-hmm. is it, how are your finances structured? Like, is it financially feasible? And the answer is it's not, but raising kids in the US is not financially feasible for anyone. So
right, exactly.
You have to make your own choices there. And then one of the questions was like, does this mean you're never dating ever again?
Mm.
And that one was really interesting. A lot of people ended up meeting somebody much later, you know, when their kid was 3 or 4 or 2 or 7. And a lot of people I know said, yeah, I'm not dating for a long time. This is just where I'm going to focus my energy and attention.
Mm-hmm. So did asking all these questions and getting all these various answers, how did it make you feel? Like, did it make you move in one direction or the other, or, you know, think, okay, this is the path for me?
Yeah, 100%. It did two things. One is it launched my podcast, Storked, because I was asking people who were solo parents, but I was also asking people who were not parents, like, you chose not to have kids. What's that like? Or people who were step parents. You know, I was asking everyone everything at that time because I was imagining all the various lives. It's like when you go looking to rent a new condo or something, and you like go into various homes and you're like, what would it feel like to live in this home?
Mm-hmm.
Or when you're job hunting, you're like, what does it feel like to have this career? It's kind of like that. It's like, what does it feel like to live the life of somebody who's a step parent? What does it feel like to live the life of somebody who's a solo parent? What's it feel like to live the life of somebody who chooses to have kids or not have kids? And I think just the more I heard about it, the more it just felt like it was right for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't give you an exact example. I couldn't say this said it was right for me. It was just like, I heard answers that made me feel like I wasn't alone in this path. I heard answers that made me feel like it was going to be challenging, but figure outable.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard answers that made my soul like sing, basically that being a parent is the greatest thing in the world for people who really want to parent. And whether or not some dude is in your life shouldn't get in your way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely. So when you talk about some of the challenges,
yeah,
what were some of the things that came up like as examples of like the hardest challenges? And how did you feel when you heard those specific things?
Yeah. So there was one woman I talked to who I was friendly with at the time. I think her kid was 4 at the time. And she was talking about how just emotionally exhausting it was to be on all the time, like 100% on.
Mm.
And so her solution, and she was very lucky to have this solution, was on the weekends to drive 2 hours to her parents' house and to set up a bedroom for herself and her son in her parents' house and spend the weekends with them. And that sounded like, okay, that's a great creative solution. Do I want to spend that much time with my parents? do they want to spend that much time with me? You know?
Right.
And so that one was sort of speaking to how much you're pulled in so many directions and how exhausting and emotional it can be, but also how challenging childcare is to find and
right,
good supportive childcare and how expensive it is. Right.
Mm-hmm.
She was also the person who told me it can be hard to be the one who's doing all of the things, but you're also the one who gets all of the love, right? So
The
kid loves you 100% because there's no one else that gets the kisses and the goodnight hugs and the,
mm-hmm,
you know, that you get all of it. You get to soak up all of the joy. And that has proven to be really true for me.
Yeah.
There was another woman I met later on who had a similar problem with childcare and ended up moving home with her parents permanently. Again, a luxury if you have parents in your life who can support you, but it's right, not always doable. There was a woman I met at the time who was living in New York City, and she said, my finances just cannot do this. They can't do it. So she had to move to the Midwest where she was originally from. And mm-hmm, I think the cultural adjustment was challenging. It was, this is not my home. This doesn't feel right for me, but it's right for my child.
Right.
So some of the trade-offs are a little bit more stark when you're a solo mm-hmm parent than, but parenting, unfortunately, and fortunately, is all about trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think it brings up the question that you explore on Storked a lot, like, what is family, right? Like, yeah. And I'd love to ask you that question, you know, in your mind, what is family?
Yeah. And it's so funny to have the tables turned with that question.
Right.
I ask that at the end of every
episode. Switching up the tables on you, Julia.
Gosh, I like being the person who asks the questions. What I'm finding is family is really community. And that sounds so obvious, but it's the person who will come over at midnight because your son has fallen down the stairs and has a concussion and you need help getting to the hospital. That's a good friend of mine.
Did that happen to you?
That happened to me. Jokes. And I was like, this is one of those things where you're like, if I had another partner in the house, it would be an obvious choice, but my car was down the street and, you know, I didn't feel safe getting him to the hospital without a car seat. And mm-hmm. so, and I, you know, you didn't want to take a child. It was the middle of winter last year. I didn't want to take a sick child running through the streets in the snow to try and find the car. So I called a friend. She came over at midnight and she helped me get to the hospital. It's that. It's the community of people who will show up for you, whether it's yeah. emotionally or I had another friend. There was a day that I was packing for, it was also last winter, I was packing for the Christmas holidays. And I just found that navigating the packing experience and a young child was slowly killing me. I just couldn't get everything into the bag at once. So I said, I'm leaving for the airport in an hour. Would you come over and hang out with us?
Yeah.
And she did. It's the person you can say, hey, I don't have anyone else to bounce these parenting questions off of. How are you handling sleep? You know, or how are mm-hmm. you handling this now, this thing about food or whatever it is that's happening in your child's life? Or the person who says, you seem really stressed. Can I take you for coffee? The community is everything. Having a supportive community is the most important thing any of us can have in life in general, mm-hmm. as parents, as solo parents.
Right.
Yeah.
So tell me, okay, so spoiler alert, you do have a son.
Yes, yes. We jumped over that part.
Yes, we did. But I do want to backtrack to that. So let's talk about when you finally did make that decision that you were going to go for it on your own. And first, I want to talk about the terminology and like, I hate to put a label on anything, but is it solo parent by choice, single parent by choice? Like, do you have a thing that you call it and that you prefer, just because I always want to try to get the vernacular right and make sure that I'm not, you know, offending anybody or saying the right thing. So how do you explain the terminology, first of all? And then I want to talk about how you got into it all.
Sure. I have a strong preference for solo parent by choice because solo to me describes the parenting experience and single sort of describes where you are in your dating life. So
interesting. I like that distinction. Yeah.
So I've dated people and they have known my son, but they're not a parent. They're not helping in the parenting in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And I think that's a really important thing. If somebody were to be serious enough in my life that the designation would warrant a change, that's totally different than somebody that I go out for a drink with. So yeah, for me, I really prefer solo parenting because I am the primary parent. I am the parent. Mm-hmm. There is no other parent. But I know a lot of other people prefer single parent by choice or other terminology. There's interesting controversy around the by choice as well. Mm-hmm. For me, I chose this. I absolutely made a decision. I spent a lot of time in reflection. I spent a lot of time with a fertility doctor. I mean, this was an active choice. However, some people will argue that the dating market is such that these days it isn't a choice. There's no alternative. There's just not enough wonderful humans to partner with. And so I think you could make that argument too.
Right. That's so interesting. And it brings me to think of like the childless, not by choice, or childless by choice, you know, distinction as well. And
exactly.
Again, labels, who cares, whatever, but just in the notion of trying to be thoughtful and not wanting to hurt anyone or say anything wrong. Like I always try to learn, you know, what people prefer and all that. So thank you for clearing that up. So let's get into when you made the decision. What were your first steps? Like logistically, talk us through everything you did.
Yeah. So the first thing I did when I was easing into this and thinking, okay, this is probably something I'll do, is I froze my eggs at 35. And I am super thankful that I did that. Although at the time, which was only 6 years ago, the technology wasn't as strong. There wasn't a lot of research on the efficacy of it. They're still trying to figure out the best way to de-thaw eggs. They're very fragile. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that like one round of egg freezing might not be sufficient. Like, who knew,
you know?
And now we know a lot more about all of that stuff. So that was my first step. And that was really like still an investment in the future, a backup plan. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough that I was living at my parents' house at the time, so I didn't have to pay for mortgage or rent. So I was able to save some money and do that. And then when I actually made the decision, like I actually truly made the decision, I first had a conversation with my parents and said, I'm going to go do this. I wanted their blessing, but their support. I wanted to build my community. Mm-hmm. And then I started talking to OBGYNs and fertility doctors. And the first step in any fertility journey, as you know, is to get your levels tested. And the second step in a solo parent by choice decision is to figure out where the sperm is going to come from. So found my doctor, got the fertility testing, looked like I was in a position where I'd be able to get pregnant relatively in a straightforward way. I don't want to use the word easy. It's never easy.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. Yeah.
But for me at the time, it was more straightforward. And I had to select a sperm donor, which is a really complex and interesting process.
Yeah. Let's unpack that. What was it like for you? Where did you even know where to go? Like, how do you decide all that?
Yeah. I got a list of clinics. Sorry. From my clinic, I got a list of sperm banks that were considered to be a little bit more reputable.
Okay.
I also spent some time thinking about anyone I knew in my world that might be a good known donor. There's two paths. There's known donor, somebody that you know, and there's somebody from a sperm bank. And both have their positives and negatives. A known donor obviously has some very complicated legal elements and some emotional elements, like how involved is this person going to be?
Right.
If they're very involved, then legally they might be able to claim custody down the road. If they're not involved at all, do you want your kid to know them? Like all of those things have to be hashed out and then they have to be documented in a legal document. I did have a friend that I thought would be the perfect sperm donor. I thought, you know, from an aesthetic standpoint, from a kindness standpoint, from a value standpoint, he had all of the attributes that I wanted my future child to have. And so I had a difficult conversation with him and he actually said no.
Mm.
He said, you know, I just, if I had a child that was biologically connected to me, I'd want to be very involved in their life. And
okay.
So I don't think I could do this.
And you weren't into that notion.
Yeah. I think he wasn't sure what very involved meant for him. I think in his head, it meant parenting a child full time. And so it just wasn't a right fit.
Were you shocked by that?
No, I think I was disappointed. Of course, this guy is gorgeous and kind and smart and, you know, all the things.
Yeah.
But I totally understand it, right? It's this is your DNA. It's not something to be given flippantly.
Right. Yeah.
So I went with California Cryobank, which is one of the sperm banks out there. I didn't really know what I was doing. I sort of was like, this one looks good. And
what were some of the things that you were looking for? Did you have like a checklist of like attributes or qualities or physicalities that were on your list?
I did. And for the sperm banks themselves, I didn't have any way of evaluating them. Now I know that there are some that have a little bit stronger reputations than others and adherence to best practices than others. But for the sperm donor, that was really hard. And I had heard about these things called like donor parties where you like flash the candidates on screen and everyone is drinking and having fun. And I was like, I'm going to do a donor party. And I couldn't do it. I didn't want everyone's opinion on it. So
yeah.
I did what I call a board of advisors, and I went through all of the candidates, spent a lot of time. It's like online shopping where you kind of like heart them or put them in your basket. I was looking for intelligence, which is almost immeasurable on somebody's profile.
Right.
And kindness, which is 100% immeasurable.
Right.
And then like, did they look like they would fit into my family? Although that was less important, you know, did they have a nice smile? Did they seem like they had kind eyes?
Mm-hmm.
What you're given is pictures of them as a baby. You're not given adult pictures.
Right. Okay. I know so, every place is a little slightly different, but that's how it was with that one. Okay.
That was, that's how California Cryobank did it at the time. And I picked my top, I think, 8 candidates and I called my board of directors. I had 3 friends.
Mm-hmm.
I gave them my password. I said, go in, look at these candidates, and then we're going to have a phone call about it. And what I was looking for is, like, there was one candidate I really liked, and they said, wait a minute, we're reading between the lines, and this person seems to have a huge ego, you know, and it's all about me, 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 me. Will that translate genetically into your future child? Maybe, maybe not, but do you really want that? And I said, no, I don't want that.
Interesting.
Right. And then there was somebody else who had a little health thing that I didn't pick up at first, but somebody else picked up on. But universally, my board picked the same donor, the same two, you know, this one's our favorite and this one's our second favorite. And they were my favorites too.
Okay.
So that made it easy. And it was one of those decisions. I always say this, and I think it's really important that the second I made the decision, this is my donor, I felt this like full body certainty, like,
wow.
Yeah. Like I felt relaxed. I felt like sure of myself. I felt confident. Like, yeah, this is my guy. And I felt even more sure of my solo parenting path. Like, yes, this is something I'm 100% going to do.
I love that you had this board of directors. That's is that what you called it? Board of directors?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so exactly. Cool. So can we talk finances?
Yeah.
I don't want to pry and certainly don't say anything you don't want to say, but just in the interest of education and, you know, being transparent, what was this going to cost?
Oh gosh. So the sperm is the biggest expense, or for me having my son at the time, the sperm was the biggest expense. And so vials of sperm range anywhere from $600 to $1,000 a vial. And I was working with my doctor to do IUI. So each time I did IUI, it was one vial of sperm. Mm-hmm. And the sperm is limited resource. You can get more, but it's limited. So you have to buy, you know, as many vials as you think you're going to use.
Right.
And so that's one major expense. I mean, if I told you how much I spent over a couple of year period on this donor sperm.
This episode is brought to you by Happy Mammoth. Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're definitely not alone. There are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our environment right now, in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare, and they all mess with our hormones. The good news? We don't have to suffer through any of it anymore because now we have Hormone Harmony, a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. Hormone Harmony is not just a hormone-supporting supplement. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. In fact, a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews. And there are more than 30,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. Okay, guys, so here is the very exciting news. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code INFERTILEAF at checkout. Again, that's happymammoth.com and use the code INFERTILEAF for 15% off. Thanks, Happy Mammoth.
Your jaw would drop. It's astronomical. Like,
so how do you calculate how many vials you might need? Like if you do, you know, 2 to 3 IUIs, for example, or, you know, like what is it? 10 vials? Is it, you know, like how do you even...
It's really hard to know because you don't know if your first IUI is going to work or it's going to be the fifth try.
Right.
So you definitely want to have more than one vial per intended baby. Mm-hmm. I was sort of calculating in the back of my head, maybe it would be in my insurance insists on 3 IUI attempts before moving on to IVF. So I knew it would be at least 3 vials plus okay. IVF might be a couple vials. So I was sort of calculating 5 vials per child.
Okay.
And so ended up with about 10 initially and then bought more over time. So okay.
Were you able to get the same donor when you had to buy more?
I have been able to, okay. And now there's none left. Okay. Although they do have a program where I could like beg them to contact the donor. And if he was willing, he might be able to make more sperm. And they only do that if you already have a child, because they want you to have genetic siblings. Yeah.
That's so interesting. I feel like I've never heard that on this show. And thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And that now a couple of the sperm banks have like a very expensive high-end package where you can say, I want to be one of 5 families that this donor donates to. And so I'm willing to pay extra money for that. Or I want to be the only family that this donor donates to. And so I'm going to pay even more money for that.
Wow.
And it's really expensive. And what surprises me about those programs is they come with very few vials. So I'm like, how do you think this is going to work exactly? One of the risks with going for a sperm bank is that there are no real donor caps, no legal donor caps. There's, you know, best practices, and each sperm bank has the number of families that they will cap it at. But those are based on things like reported live births. So if I have two kids and never tell the sperm bank that I had two kids with that donor, they're not going to count them in the family count.
Right.
So you're hearing stories of people whose kids have 60 or 200 siblings.
Yeah.
And that's the scariest part about being a solo parent and using sperm from a sperm bank. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people are working, one of the many things that a lot of people are working to change the laws around.
Yeah. Because like you say, there's no real way to track it, right? A lot of it is best practices. A lot of it is like honor system, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it is reporting and people getting the accurate numbers and figures and all that. So that's also a really interesting thing to consider. So does that dissuade you at all? Or once you're in it, you're like, okay, well, that's just one of the risks involved. I mean, there's risks involved in everything, obviously. So you just kind of hope that it doesn't get to anything in that realm. Or like, how did you
feel? When you're in the middle of something and you've chosen to do something, you put your blinders up and you're like, that won't happen to me.
Yeah.
You know, you're like,
yeah,
that's never, it's kind of like fertility. You're like, I'm not going to have fertility problems. I know so many people have them, but it's
story of my life.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
And then it does happen. And so it's the thing now as a parent that I am one of the things I'm most terrified about. And it's one of those things I'm just going to have to teach myself how to parent through. I'm trying to be as educated as possible. And I encourage people when they're thinking about sperm banks, just to be aware of some of the things that are less than perfect about this industry. This industry, which is amazing and gives us children,
right,
has a couple of drawbacks that you should just know going in.
Right. Are your fears based in that your son might end up like dating someone that he's related to? Or is it like a fear that you'll find out there's 60 other families or something with the same DNA?
Yeah, all of the things, right? Okay. Like how, if there are 60 other families with the same DNA and my son chooses to have a relationship with them, how is he going to have a relationship with 60 plus siblings? Or, you know, how's he going to feel about having 60 plus siblings out there? I think it's all just a little scary. The dating thing is a legit real fear. There's a lot of unintended consequences with not knowing how many donors kids are out there, and especially for those kids who don't know that they're donor conceived, which is was a standard practice in the 80s and 90s. Don't tell your kids, there's no way they're going to know.
Yep.
Well, what if they need donor sperm? You know, how do they know that they've got the right, that they're not using a related person's sperm?
Right.
Or how do they know that they're not dating somebody that they're related to, which happens all the time because they don't even know they're donor conceived. So there's a lot.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Julie, for getting into all this. I know it's personal, you know, it's a lot of personal stuff. So thank you for being so open about just your thoughts on all this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of rabbit holes to go down. So I'm
totally
going down too many.
No, I'm like, I feel like we could talk about this for hours, but let's continue on with your story. So you got the sperm that you wanted and then tell us how it went from there.
And then COVID hit. Oh my gosh. So the clinics closed. I don't know if you remember this, but the clinics were completely shut down. And I'm going, okay, I've just decided to do this. I'm on my path. How the hell am I going to have a baby? And we didn't know if the clinics were going to be closed forever. Was it going to be a month or 2 months or 3 months? So at this point, I was so far down the process. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it at home. So I tried 2 at-home inseminations with a friend of mine who is an OBGYN.
Okay.
Like on the couch, sperm donated, like shipped to my house.
Yeah. Wow.
Didn't work, but I've heard success stories with that. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be one of those success stories. I was not. Nope.
Okay.
And eventually the clinics opened back up and we did IUI. First, we did 1 unmedicated one and then we did 2 medicated ones. And the second medicated one stuck. It was the one that was not supposed to stick. You know, we might have mistimed it. We were like, should we cancel the cycle? No, let's just do it. And it worked.
Okay. Can you explain to somebody what was the reason for going to medicated from unmedicated? So somebody that might not know.
Yeah. So an IUI is commonly considered the turkey baster method. It's where they take a catheter and they put the sperm into your body. It can either be donor sperm or it can be your partner's sperm. And unmedicated means they're just, you're just tracking your normal ovulation cycle. And when you're ovulating, you go in. And medicated, you add Clomid or letrozole or something like that, that recruits more follicles and gets more to work. And you're doing more of the like evaluation and testing, the blood work and the ultrasounds. And I don't know what makes a doctor choose medicated versus unmedicated. I think it's just medication can sometimes get things growing and moving mm-hmm. faster and better. And I was 38 at the time, so it made a lot of sense for me. Okay. I know people who use medicated support at home when they're trying. So they might take Clomid with the guidance of a doctor and go home and sleep with their partner. And that's one way they get pregnant. So it's, I think it's one of the tools in your arsenal to just mm-hmm. juice the process a little bit.
Absolutely. So yeah. Tell me about when you found out the second one had stuck.
Oh my God. I was like, I just couldn't believe it. I was dying. Yeah. I was so excited. And it was, I'm so lucky. It was like a great pregnancy all the way around.
Yeah.
But it was Thanksgiving actually. So I did like one of the pee on a stick pregnancy tests and it looked positive, but you're like, I don't know if this is real. You got to wait it out a little bit. And it was Thanksgiving and I was home with my parents and I went to go get a blood test and I told them and they just like jaws on the floor, couldn't believe that this was real. But it was like, this is going to sound so obnoxious. I was so certain of my path and so convinced that things were going to work out that it seemed like, of course it worked out, you know, like, yeah, of course this worked out.
That doesn't sound obnoxious. You were confident.
I was confident. I was like, I was nervous and anxious and it didn't feel real at first, but once it felt real, I was like, yeah, this was inevitable. This was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I say that because now I'm trying for a second and I'm like, what was I thinking to think this was inevitable? This is so not inevitable. This is so hard.
Right.
And so, yeah, that just like self-assuredness, it's going to happen one way or another. There's going to be a baby that comes into my life. But to be honest, that had been my mantra for almost a decade. Like, yes, I know I'm single. Yes, I know I want to have kids. Yes, I know my heart is breaking every day because I am childless.
Yeah.
The thing in the back of my head was, it's going to happen one way or another. It's going to happen one way or another. And that's what I held on to as like the hope to get me through the pain of not having a kid in my life or mm-hmm. kids in my life. You know, it was just so raw and awful to be child-free.
Right.
And so when it finally happened, I was like, yeah, see, the mantra is right. Of course, the mantra came true. My brain knew it all along. I was holding on to this inevitability. This will happen one way or another. And it did. And I was like, yeah.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Totally. So tell me about the pregnancy. And, you know, again, as being a solo parent by choice, did you run into any circumstances that were like uncomfortable or where people would like say stupid shit or just assume you had a partner and those kinds of things? And if so, how did you deal with that?
100%. All of the things. And I actually was dating somebody at the time, which was very awkward. He lived on the other side of the country, so we didn't see each other really much at all. But when we did, one of the things I would notice is that when I would walk around visibly showing and pregnant, people would either ignore me or like maybe they'd smile or like whatever. But when he was walking around with me, people would look him in the eye and be like, congratulations.
Oh, wow.
Like, congratulating him. I'm like, this isn't his baby.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Why does he get the congrats? I did all the work. Nobody knows that, of course.
Right.
But, you know, because it's the solo versus single thing. I will say it's exceedingly awkward to date somebody when you're pregnant with a sperm donor. You know, when you're like, I'm pregnant. It's not yours. You're not the parent. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of uncomfortableness there. And that's probably another podcast episode about dating as a solo parent. But the other things were mostly I got support when I told people, and I still like, I'll be on the playground and somebody will say, oh, you know, what does your husband do? Or, where's your partner? What's your kid's other parent like? And I am always saying, well, it's just me. And I chose to have him as a sperm donor. He's a sperm donor baby, or I chose to have him on my own and I used a donor. Mm-hmm. And there's this like moment where everyone pauses and then they apologize. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean. And they feel like they've done something wrong. Asking where a child's parent is and listening when somebody says that they don't have another parent, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It's right? There's, you didn't do anything wrong by making an assumption. It's if there were negative comments like, oh, you did that or why, or, you know.
Right. I mean, I think just human wise, yeah. You know, people don't want to, like, they do feel bad for assuming that, like, oh, that was so, you know, like,
yeah,
dumb of me to assume that you have a partner, you know, so I get it.
And people don't know how to react. I think there's one of two things. There's either an, oh, I'm sorry, kind of freak out, in which case you're almost making it feel like a bad thing. Like, oh, I'm sorry this happened to you. Mm. When instead it's like, oh, that's great to know. Thank you. It normalizes it rather than apologizes for it. So the apology response is kind of interesting. Or the, wow, that's so brave response, which I don't think is true either. It's not a bravery thing. Anyone who's gone through infertility knows when you are, or anyone who's been single and wanting a child in your life, when you want a child in your heart, you would do anything. Like, mm-hmm. you feel like you would do anything to fill that void. So I don't feel like it's brave to pursue the thing that you want most in life.
Yeah. Has anybody said anything that really was the exact right thing to say, do you think?
That's a great question. Nothing jumps out.
Yeah.
Nothing jumps out.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I was just thinking, I wonder if there's anybody that said something that really resonated with you that we could pass on to people who are listening. Like, here's the thing to say if you come across this circumstance, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And maybe there isn't one.
You know, I think maybe curiosity. That's great. I'd like to learn more about that one day if you're open to it. Would be interesting. Or, you know, I think just a normal response. Okay, cool. Like if I said my husband's a lawyer. Okay, cool. Or my husband doesn't work. He's actually at home with my kids right now. Or my wife does this. Like, so yeah, I think the more we normalize things and don't have big reactions, positive or negative, is better.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody said, what does your husband do? And I said, actually, my wife is a doctor. Would you be like, oh, I'm so sorry for asking? Or like, oh, that's so brave of you to marry a woman. No, you're just like, cool. What kind of medicine does she practice? You know?
Right, right. Exactly. Well, I love that you're normalizing it by talking about this today. So let's move on to kind of where you're at now. You said, you know, that you're trying again. Is that right? Is that, that's okay to say? So tell us how you got to that point. How old is your son now?
So my son is 2.5.
Okay.
And I haven't told a lot of people that I'm trying again because initially when I started to mention that I wanted a second, I got a lot of pushback.
Really? Why?
Yeah. So the same people that were supporting me for choosing to have a family on my own terms and have to go the solo parent journey to do that route. Those people who are like, I support you. This is amazing. I want you to have what you want. You know, you're going to be a great mom. This is wonderful. When I started to say that I wanted a second, they would say, oof, that's so selfish. You know?
What?
Yes.
Selfish.
I got that so much. It's really, how could you become an old mom? You know, because I'm a little bit older now, I'm 41. Your kid's going to have an old parent, or, you know, how are you going to juggle everything? That's not fair to your kids. It's not fair. Yeah. A lot of selfishness comments.
Wow. How did that make you feel?
Awful, right? Yeah,
pissed off.
Yes. I don't feel selfish.
No.
In fact, I almost feel like it's more important that I give my child a sibling because there's fewer of us in the family, right? Mm-hmm. If I, God forbid, something happens to me, you want that child to have more love and support from somebody who's in it with them, a sibling. And also from a DNA perspective, I want my child to share DNA with somebody else, right? He's only 50% mine. And he doesn't know 50% of his DNA and might never know 50% of his DNA. So if he has a sibling who matches his DNA, wouldn't that be amazing?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel like it's selfish at all, but I got a lot of selfishness comments. I think the fear a lot of people have is that if something does happen to me, somebody is taking on not one, but two children.
Mm.
And that's something you have to think about as a solo parent before, like the second you get pregnant, you have to get your legal documents in a row. Like who is taking this child? Because it's not automatically going to be your partner.
Right.
If there's a crisis.
Okay.
There's no partner to take them. Right. So selfishness. And then a lot of my friends who have more than one kid would call me and say, do you know how hard this is? Do you know how hard it is to take two kids? You can't do this on your own. Two kids is impossible. Wow. How can you do it on your own? So the tone went from bravery, support, love, you know, the community fell apart when I said I wanted a second.
That's so interesting and shitty too at the same time.
Shitty.
So how did you react to people that would call you selfish?
Honestly, I just shut down and I stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. We have to put the walls up at a certain point and just protect your heart and your mental state. And, you know what's best for you, obviously. So I'm sorry that that happened. And, you know, I don't understand it. I feel like that would not be my reaction at all to somebody, but, you know, to each his own, I guess. But you put, you know, you, that didn't change your opinion, obviously, right? You did, you're doing what you want to do. So tell me more about the process and getting into it with the second go round.
Yeah. You know, I've got so much conviction on this that it's impossible to change my mind around it. All it does when you tell me that it's selfish or that having two kids is impossible as a solo parent is it makes me distance myself from the friendship or the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like you're just causing a wedge for us. But for next steps, I went back to my reproductive endocrinologist and he's like, okay, let's get started. One of the things I found really challenging is I was nursing at the time and he said, well, you know, you can't be nursing and on fertility medication, so you've got to stop nursing. And my kid did not want to wean. So it was like months of this internal debate of, do I force him in order to have another child or do I wait and like every month I'm losing fertility, I'm getting older, right? Like, how do you balance the kid's needs of the child that you have versus the child that you don't yet have?
Right.
A first challenge in having more than one kid is their competing needs.
Absolutely.
And you know this, right? How do you do that? So I took my time to wean and now I'm like, oh, did I lose precious months? Because I'm now almost a year into the trying process and every month counts, right? This clock is ticking.
Right.
In the intervening. So from October to October, we tested my levels and like they had dropped a bunch since when I tried to have my first son. And now they've dropped a bunch more. Mm-hmm. And so it's increasingly harder. We did 3 medicated IUIs, which were not successful. And then we had a 4th medicated IUI, which did result in a pregnancy. And then a miscarriage at 9 weeks.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And talk about, I mean, I said this before, like, I know all the stats. I knew miscarriage was highly likely at my age, you know, 1 in 4.
Doesn't make it any easier.
No, you're like, this isn't it. No, it can't be happening to me. Right.
Absolutely.
You're seeing the ultrasound without a heartbeat and there had been a heartbeat previously. And you're like, no. Like if the tech just moves the device,
you'll
find the heartbeat. Or if I go to a different tech, like that heartbeat is there. We saw it last week.
Right.
No.
Oh, so when was that? Was that recently?
Yeah, that was in October of this year.
Okay. October, so sorry.
Thank you.
Right. So how do you, it's hard, right? I mean, obviously that's an understatement, but how did you navigate that, you know, grieving and you still have your baby and you're doing this solo and all that? Like, how did you get through that time? I mean, not that it's over. You're still going through it. Grief is obviously not linear and it doesn't end.
You know, I thought it was over. This is so naive and stupid of me. I know it's not a linear process. I know that grief comes and goes in waves. But what is wrong with me? Sometimes I just think that, like, I'm immune from what happens to the rest of the world. And I was like, I'm fine. I got this. I'm like, I've cried myself to tears. I've like let it all out and now I'm fine. And then it just resurfaced this past week. And I was going, wait, I think this is the grief showing up and causing me to act in erratic ways. So it's a good lesson for myself that it never really goes away. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I mean, I had to go through the whole DNC process and I guess people have others come into the hospital room with them. Like if you're having a DNC and you have a partner, does your partner come do that with you?
I never had any DNCs, but I think it just depends on the hospital.
Yeah. I did it myself. That was fine. My mom picked me up. She happened to be in town at the time.
Yeah.
And I was lucky that I had childcare, like a babysitter and people who could watch my son so that I could take a couple of hours and heal. Mm-hmm. But then you're still putting on dinner, you know, and you still need bedtime. So the crying had to be sort of scheduled late night and at times when it was just safe to do so.
Right. Exactly. So where are you at today, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm like in the middle of a little bit of a crisis. I, after the miscarriage, had a failed IVF attempt. So I did one round of IVF, which was canceled. That was in December. Mm-hmm. And we were regrouping and trying to supposed to start an IVF round like this week. And I ended up panicking and maybe switching doctors. And I think I made the right choice, but maybe I didn't. And I'm pretty sure that my anxiety just drove me to like act rashly and make a major decision, like switching doctors in the heat of the moment. And so I'm in like a little bit of an emotional spiral around what's the right next step and am I using the right doctor and what do I do next kind of thing. But I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. I am hopeful that we're going to do a round or two of IVF that is successful, that results in embryos. Mm-hmm. That's my sincere hope.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll be following along and, you know, I'm sure you'll be talking about this as well on your Storked podcast. Before we wrap, Julia, can you tell me and anyone listening, you know, this has been so good, by the way. Thank you so much. I love this conversation. I feel like I could talk to you for several hours. Like, I'm like, I can't believe it's already wrapping up, but you know, I'd love to hear for somebody who might be considering going the solo parent route, what are a couple of things that you know now that you wish you knew at the beginning?
For starters, build your community early, mm-hmm. right? Build the people who are going to be by your side no matter what. And that community might change. The people who are by your side one minute might not be by your side the next, as I've learned. And you have to be really intentional about who's in your inner circle. Not everyone's going to get it immediately, or they may eventually come to get it. You know, one of my close friends was a big naysayer at first. Don't do this. This is, why would you be a solo parent? And now she's very supportive and, you know, possibly even considering it for herself. So people can change, but there's going to be a small number of people in your inner circle that warrant that you are my family. You're of my heart. You're of my soul family. Mm-hmm. And those people are going to be your ride or die. And it is impossible to do any parenting journey, but especially a solo parenting journey without them. Mm-hmm. The second is that everyone will take their tone from you. So if you're ashamed to be a solo parent and somebody says, you know, oh, you don't have a parent in your life, or your kid goes, where's my dad? Your reaction, if it's a shame or fear-based, is going to inform how people react. If you're like, yeah, I'm solo and it's great, then everyone is going to sort of take that tone from you. So you have to really be certain, clear in yourself and find that conviction that you're on the right path, which I have. I mean, I'm so glad I did this. And for those people who choose it, it is one of the most beautiful and miraculous paths you can walk. Parenting is the best thing in the world, and doing it this way is really, really special. It is definitely not for everyone, but if it is for you, don't have a doubt in your mind. Just jump right in. It's awesome.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to check out Work of Art, my children's book about IVF and ART. You can find it at infertileafgroup.com. And feel free to reach out if you guys have any questions about it. We also offer bulk orders to clinics and coaches and anybody who wants to gift books to their patients or graduating clients. So keep that in mind. I also want to remind you guys about Fertility Rally, which is the community that I have with Blair Nelson. It's such a great group of people. It's people who are going through so many different things. There's hundreds of us all over the place. Somebody you can definitely relate to. But check out fertilityrally.com or check us out on Instagram at Fertility Rally. Our membership is always open. We have 5 to 6 support groups per week and so much more. So let me know if you guys need anything. If you're going through a hard time, I see you. I feel you. I love you. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you guys next time.